You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of the Effective Statistician. Today, I'm super happy to have Katrin back on the show. Hi, Katrin. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you? Happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you. And today we talk about two acronyms that have an interesting correlation to each other: Real World Evidence, RWE, and the Joint Clinical Advice, JCA. But before we dive into the topic, Katrin, maybe you can talk a little bit about where you're coming from and what brought you into this real world evidence space.
Yeah, happy to do. I'm a statistician, a director in statistics, and I have greater than 10 years experience in HTA, and I'm actively engaged as a European HTA activities, and especially when it comes to evidence generation outside of an RCT. I'm now in a new position as a director for real world evidence. Real world evidence is very important when you do not have RCT data in hand for generating all the evidence needed for this new European HTA process, JCA. I'm always trying to link those two topics and to bring people together and to discuss evidence generation plans and have workflows ready to answer all those questions in this HTA process, and to be able to use real-world evidence when there is a right use case for that. So yeah, I'm dealing with those two topics since quite a while now, and it's very interesting, and it's very difficult to marry them because in HTA, there's a strong focus on randomized controlled trials, on certainty of analysis results, and on the other hand, we have a lot of data outside of a randomized controlled trial. We have a lot of real-world evidence available. We have strong data available. And we need to do more to be able to answer the right question with the data.
Yeah. So let's directly dive into the use cases for using real-world evidence in the JCA process. And I think we can already think about two different scenarios. One is you have a first JCA, so the molecule is completely new on the market. So you probably don't have any real-world evidence for your new molecule, but you have it for other comparator data. The second scenario could be that you have a new indication for your molecule. And so therefore, you have at least safety data and these kind of things, and maybe some off-label data for your molecule that is coming from real-world evidence. So I think these two different cases we need to have a look into. So depending on these two, what are good use cases for real-world evidence and joint clinical advice?
Let's start with the first scenario as the JCA kicked off on January 12th. Those will be the most relevant use cases because the JCA is only happening for new drugs that come to the market. For the JCA, you will get a number of different PICOs you have to answer: population, intervention, comparator, and outcome. Those PICOs have to fulfill the needs of all 27 member states. So you will end up with a lot of comparators. You will definitely not have any randomized trial data against those comparators. Real-world evidence can be really important to fill this gap and to have effectiveness effectiveness includes safety comparisons there with comparators you do not have in your randomized data, especially when you might have a new drug where the studies that have been run for those comparators are old, where you might have some bias due to change in standard of care or change in disease management. You cannot use published data from clinical trials, but you might want to use actual real-world data for those comparators to avoid this bias. So that can be the basis for an indirect treatment comparison. That is a comparator you don't have direct evidence against. Of course, the data also helps you to define patient numbers, treatment patterns, the patient journey to get a full picture of the drug. But for the JCAs, the most relevant one is really the indirect treatment comparison. And that's the one where the final guidelines are open for it. They draw all the limitations which are there, but they are open for it. It's described as a use case, the indirect treatment comparisons versus real data. And that's the most important one. So for the second scenario, when you have your drug on the market.
Let's double click on this indirect comparison. Here we have very often indirect comparisons without a bridge comparator, I would say. Yeah. So it's not so typical indirect comparison like you have two studies, both compared to placebo, and then you use placebo as a bridge comparator. It's likely that you have two arms, one from an RCT and the other from observational data. And now you need to put them next to each other and have an indirect comparator without, of course, that makes things much more complicated.
Yes, a non-randomized comparison is much more complicated when it comes from a method standpoint, but also when it comes to assessing the bias you can have there. Mm. With randomization, you make sure that you have a balanced assignment to the two treatment groups with respect to disease characteristics of the patient. You do not have a patient selection due to the treatment. You also have the same starting point, the same index date for your comparison. So there are so many sources of bias that you can have when you do a non-randomized comparison. It's really of importance not to focus on the statistical methods here, but to also focus on the selection of the data source, on identifying the different sources of bias, and then adjusting with the right statistical method to be able to rule out any bias that might be due to confounding. And then, of course, there's always unknown, unmeasured confounding to do a quantitative bias assessment to try to quantify the remaining residual bias you can have there.
And we'll dive deeper into biases later in this episode. So that was the first use case. What's the second use case?
So the second use case, when you have your drug already on the market in another indication, you could use real-world evidence to get more safety data, maybe also on long-term safety data from real-world data, clinical settings of this drug. You mentioned it in the beginning. If there is some off-label use already for your new indication, when the indications are closed and there might be off-label use, you can already maybe use that data for a direct comparison. The issue is when you use real-world data of your new drug, you might have a strong selection bias compared to the old standard of care. You might have very different patient populations taking the new drug and taking the old drugs. So that's one of the drawbacks, but you might have data collected at the same time period. There's a different source of bias you get in those use cases, and you have to make sure to understand those sources of bias fully, then take a decision. Do you have the data that can answer the question you want to answer? Is it possible to adjust for that bias? Is it possible to quantify it or not?
Of course, it's important to look into how you collect data. One source could be registries or claims databases. If you plan for prospective observational studies, comparative prospective observational studies, when you launch your first indication, that can help you for later indications, at least from a safety point of view. And if you are comparators, similar indications that you want to go into, this could be good use cases for prospective observational studies.
Absolutely, fully agree. You mentioned a very good point. Assessment of endpoints, assessment of data, very important. When you think of an oncology example, not just when you look into real-world data itself, but also when you look into a clinical trial versus real-world data. In a clinical trial, you do the assessment by imaging, whereas in real-world, in the clinical practice, there might be symptoms associated, there might not be an image all the time. So you might have different time points when you assess a progressive disease and a different assessment of that endpoint. So that's also very critical to look into that. But if you are able to collect the real-world data prospectively, you are able to define how the endpoints are assessed. You are able to define the patient population for both groups. You can emulate a target trial instead of, but you just leave out the randomization there. But all the other things you can try to make as similar as feasible between the two arms to have more comparable data. Very important.
What further use cases would you foresee using real-world evidence for the transclinical assessment?
Real-world evidence can be also very helpful to have a look into trial feasibility. So when you prepare for JCA and data, you can see patient numbers. Is it feasible to recruit the patients for a trial that fulfills the JCA needs? The patient journey might be very important to understand how to design a trial to make sure that the patient benefits from the drug. So trial feasibility is really a very important one. Of course, you can use real-world data to understand prognostic and predictive factors for the treatment outcome. And that's also very important when you want to run an indirect treatment comparison, that you have a full understanding. What are the prognostic predictive factors? What might be possible confounders as well that you have to adjust for? So then, of course, you can look at your health technology in the real-world setting, so external validity. So if you have a randomized trial, it focuses more on internal validity and you look at the causal treatment effect, but what's the external validity? How does the health technology show effectiveness in the real world and the standard care outside of the clinical trial setting?
That is especially for the comparators also very relevant.
Yes.
And whether the comparators, how much are they used? And are they used in the same way as in the clinical trial in terms of dosage, frequency, whatsoever?
Absolutely. And also the effectiveness. It can be very different in the real world because you might have much more different factors that come in. And it can be very simple ones like the region the patient is living in and the access he has to different drugs and different care outside of the treatment. So there's a lot of things that can be assessed using real world evidence. Also in rare diseases, one of the use cases, which is already very established, is to really enrich the data of a control group and use historical data and real-world evidence to borrow data for that enrichment. And that's very established already, and it's a very important use case if you have only a few patients and a very rare disease to be able to have enough power.
Yeah, that is definitely a super interesting use case. And one that is not just relevant for the joint clinical advice, but potentially also for your regulatory submission. Having these things in place is important. Now, a couple of the use cases you mentioned not just come into place when you do the JCA, but much earlier in the process. Looking into real-world evidence is not an exercise that you do 1 year before you want to launch the product, but throughout the development period, for example, when you speak about trial feasibility or informing patient prior distributions or prognostic predictive factors, all these use cases happen far earlier in the development pipeline. That calls for having a good integrated evidence plan. You lose a lot of opportunities if you just focus on your clinical trials for your regulatory submission.
Identifying important data gaps very early on and understanding, can those questions that we have, can those be answered with evidence? The focus of course, filling data gaps for the medical community, because there's a lot of questions outside of the clinical trial that cannot be answered. But also having in mind already the HTA assessment, the market access environment, where you have to show that you are better than the standard of care. And having that early on in mind to have a good strategy for real-world evidence use is very important. The integrated evidence plan is one of those tools that really of utmost importance for that, to define the data gaps and understand which data can answer which question. Real-world evidence cannot answer every question, definitely not. But it definitely has an important place in the whole strategy of generating evidence.
Let's look into bias assessment, because that is a very important thing. In preparing for this podcast episode recording, we talked about publications that introduces a tool called Robin's Eye. So can you expand on what that is and why this is important for the joint clinical assessment?
The Robin's Eye tool is a tool that gives you a very focused workflow, how to assess how much bias do I have in my comparison. And the bias here is defined as a tendency for results to differ systematically from a perfectly designed randomized trial in a huge patient group without any flaws. The tool looks at different types of bias that can happen. It looks at the patient selection for the trial. It looks at confounding. It looks at the assessment of outcomes. It looks at many different dimensions to come up with a conclusion. Does this trial have a high risk of bias or a low risk of bias? The Robin's Eye tool is meant for non-randomized cohort trials that compare one drug versus the other. It's a very useful tool that lets you think very early on the possibilities of bias you have in there. And it does not only focus on confounding, it focuses on the other things as well, on the trial design, on the patient selection. And it gives you a very structured approach to look at your bias.
Yeah.
So it's a very useful tool, and it's mentioned in the JCA guidelines that this has to be filled for every non-randomized comparison that you want to show.
And we'll put a link to use this into the show notes, as well as a link to a presentation that Katrin provided some time ago that goes into lots of these use cases, as well as the confounding. In summary, there's a lot of opportunities for real-world evidence within the joint clinical assessment. Key things are that you plan for these very early on, because clinical trials are just one source, and getting the real-world evidence data will take you some time. You need to have all of that kind of pre-planned so that you can respond to questions from the JCA in this 100-day period pretty fast, and you need to have a good understanding of all the different biases. What else are key points that listeners should take into consideration when using real-world evidence for this joint clinical assessment?
So what is very important is a full understanding of the different sources of bias, then a pre-specification of the analysis methods to avoid results-driven conclusions. Sometimes you cannot pre-specify everything fully, because sometimes you have to have seen the data, what to do that if you think of imputation of missing data, but you can have a decision tree to avoid that you do that results-driven. And then, of course, a scientific sound methodology to adjust for confounders that you have identified before. And I always recommend to really look into the literature, to talk to experts, to have a full knowledge, or try to get the full knowledge of all the possible confounders, and not focus on the variables you have measured in your data, because that's what people often do. They do not have the full picture, and they look at the data, I have those variables, and I adjust for those covariates, and then I'm fine if I do that for all of them. Really get a full picture. Adjust for the ones you have, use propensity score methods, use a lot of sensitivity analysis to show the robustness. And then a very important point is QBA, quantitative bias analysis. For sure, if you have a known confounder that you have not measured in your data, you can adjust your treatment effect and you can adjust for that confounding, but you will have a lot of unknown confounding where you do not know the effect. And then there's a lot of possibilities there. You can do tipping point analysis, which effect of a confounder variable and which imbalance can explain the treatment effect solely by confounding. If those examples are very extreme, it's very unlikely that you see a result just due to confounding. There's also single number summaries like the E value, which you can show there, or the robustness value, I like much more because you can set it into context and it has thresholds. So there's many possibilities to do a quantitative bias analysis and to quantify the bias you might have in your results to show the robustness, and also to convince HTA bodies, especially when you know that you have used real-world data, that you do not have a randomization. I think that's one of the steps that should be a standard in every real-world evidence analysis, to quantify the bias you still have in there.
Thanks so much. Yeah, completely agree. Get a good understanding of the sources of bias and quantify these will make all the difference for increasing the trust into your analysis. Thanks so much, Katrin, for this great episode.
Thank you.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.